The next case is 04-1594, the M. Conley Company versus Arthur Anderson L. Mr. Conley. Let me advise you, on our light system here, when you have a discrete time split, at the end of 7.5 minutes, the red light will light for a few seconds to let you know that you're into your time of your co-counsel, Mr. Vixenstein.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I'd also like to reserve about 5 minutes for rebuttal, which I would also split with Mr. Vixenstein. Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, my name is Craig Conley. I'm counsel for the appellant, the M. Conley Company. Having appeared before this court before, I know the court has read the briefs. Just want to briefly summarize the factual circumstances. The Teamsters Union struck my client at midnight on July 1, 2002. In a somewhat unusual turn of events, the strike never formally ended. In fact, it lasted a little more than a year, finally was terminated by operation of law when the union was decertified. I think it was in late July of 2003. At the outset, several workers, I believe three or four, opted to cross the picket line, resigned the union to avoid union fines and penalties, and returned to their positions of employment. During the strike, the first week of the strike or so, the company used primarily management people. That proved to be pretty unworkable, having management people work 25 hours a day, essentially. So the company then began to hire temporary replacement workers, manpower, Kelly girl type replacement workers. That too proved to be unworkable because there was a revolving door of turnover. So about the third week of the strike, I believe the record reflects July 19, the company hired permanent replacement workers and began to do so at that point. During the strike, as the record reflects, there were several employees. This is after the initial employees had crossed the picket line, inquired as to whether or not they too could return to work. They were advised in the affirmative. Come back to work, same position, same pay. They ultimately opted not to return to work. The company advised the union, I think it was July 19, that it was in the process of hiring permanent replacement workers. Sometime shortly thereafter, the union advised its strikers to apply for unemployment benefits, and that's what brings us here today. The union took what I call the etched in stone position, everybody returns to work or no one returns to work, or words to that effect. The company indicated a post-strike willingness to continue negotiations. There was no lockout. The strike, nonetheless, was never satisfied, was never settled. Under the U.S. Supreme Court in McKay Radio, the court has made it clear that the mere hiring of permanent replacements does not terminate the employment of the strikers. Nonetheless, the state of Ohio took the position at the administrative level that when the company began, not even completed, but when the company began to hire permanent replacements, it had thereby terminated the strikers.
Mr. Conley, let me ask you what I think is a threshold question. I voted to allow this case, as you know, for review in the merits, and I'm not certain now I see a legal issue. Why is this case not just an application, not just, but an application of existing law? We've got several cases and we've got federal law. Why is it not an application of the law to the facts as the Court of Appeals and the trial judge and as you are describing them?
Well, because, first of all, Your Honor, with all due respect to the court, I'm not sure I understand the so-called Bayes test or the bow test. And all counsel in this case have put different spins on what those cases mean. And this is a pretty unique circumstance of a strike never having been settled except by operation of law having been terminated. The Bayes test seems to say, and I believe it was syllabus law, that the test is which side first broke the status quo. Well, clearly, that was the union. The union went on strike. So under the Bayes test, if it's interpreted as I would interpret it, I would presume the company should have prevailed at all levels below. Under the Bow test, which I think is a proximate cause test, well, who caused the unemployment? Well, again, it goes back to the union. Union struck. The company hired permanent replacements as a matter of economic survival.
Well, isn't it also a question of who changed the status quo? And you look at the events to see what the status quo was. In this instance, as you know, in Bayes, I think some of the union workers came back to work. Here, I guess a few did, then they left. But factually, isn't it, this case is a little different than Bayes, isn't it?
Factually, this case is a little different than all the cases counsel, Your Honor. I think this case is more closely factually akin to the appellate cases upon which I relied, that is Moriarty and High State, in that those courts, I believe, found that the mere hiring of permanent replacement workers does not evoke entitlement to unemployment compensation. But I'm not sure any of the cases cited by counsel are really on point with the rather unique factual circumstances of this case.
Mr. Connolly, let me try to follow up on the Chief's question then. I think what we're looking at is, under either test that you've indicated, either the Bayes or the Bow test, what is the law that you want the Connolly case to stand for? What is the law that you think should be the law of this case? Is it a rewrite of either of those, or is it a different rule?
Perhaps a clarification of those cases.
In what regard?
A more fact-specific clarification. I'm not asking this court to rewrite the law or ignore stare decisis, and I would refer the court to my proposition of law number one, that an employer's mere hiring of permanent replacement workers during an economic strike does not in and of itself effectuate striking employees' qualification for unemployment compensation benefits.
But doesn't that run afoul of Bow? You told us you don't want to rewrite it, and just what you've articulated seems to be at odds with that rule.
I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I believe in Bow, it is a proximate cause sort of test. By the hiring of permanent replacements pursuant to the United States Supreme Court, we're not terminating anybody's employment. That's what the Supreme Court of the United States said in interpreting the National Labor Relations Act. So if we're not terminating employees merely by hiring permanent replacements, the company is not the proximate cause of the termination of employees, because there has been no termination.
So then, counsel, your rule that you would have us write, that is, before a striking worker can qualify for unemployment benefits when the company employs permanent replacement workers, that the striking worker must ask to be returned to work and be rejected?
Yes.
That's the rule of law you'd like to see?
Yes.
Even when the status quo has changed? For example, my understanding is that the wage and benefit package had changed once the permanent replacements were put on the books.
That is not correct, Your Honor. The wage package was identical. The benefit package could not de jure be the same because the health insurance and the pension were Teamster plans. None of the replacement workers were members of the Teamsters, therefore were not eligible for the Teamster health care and the Teamster pension.
So then the employees who were still Teamsters, if they went back to work, they would lose their status as union workers, correct, and not be eligible for their Teamster benefits?
Not necessarily. It would depend whether or not they resigned as Teamsters.
Well, how could
they
come back?
There's no requirement. Oh, of course they can come back to work without resigning. There's no such requirement. The three or four people that did come back did opt to resign in order to avoid fines and penalties that are in the Teamster bylaws, but there's no such requirement. Of course they could come back to work and still maintain their Teamster status, and of course they could have settled the strike and come back to work and maintain their Teamster status. So I want to have some time for Mr. Bickstenstein, Your Honor.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Conley. Mr. Bickstenstein, I'm sorry.
Your Honor, I'm Bart Bickstenstein. I'm here on behalf of the Ohio Management Lawyers Association. We're dedicated to issues concerning labor and employment as it applies to employers, and we thank the court and the M. Conley Company for the privilege of addressing the court today. I'm going to go directly to the question of the Chief Justice, if I may, because I believe the court needs to has a desire on that. What is going on here is that there is a split in the districts where they are not, where one of the districts, the most recent one, the fifth, is not correctly following the foundations of law established in Baugh and Bays. This case is essentially the reverse factually of the Baugh case. In the Baugh case, which was the earlier one, the court was faced with a situation in which there were hiring of permanent replacements, and it concluded that the employer had gone beyond hiring permanent placements to inform them that their jobs were, or their employment was no longer there. That is, that their employment status had terminated. And it was on that basis that the court concluded that those employees, when their employment status was terminated, became again eligible for unemployment compensation benefits. So you had, and the Baugh court talked about proximate cause because it was applying the statute where the statute referred to a disqualification for labor disputes other than a lockout, as long as it was due to a labor dispute other than a lockout. And the as long as it was due was where the court looked at that and said, that tells us proximate cause is a question. How long is the lack of employment due to the labor dispute as opposed to something else? And it concluded, well, when the employment relationship is terminated, and it actually used the said, it said, this is the pivotal question, is the status as an employee ended? If that status is ended, then there is a re-entitlement to unemployment comp. So the factual scenario in Baugh was employment status was terminated, and Baugh applied its proximate cause test to say that meant you were now entitled. Here we have what has happened, though, in the interim is that the commission has read Baugh essentially to say that permanent replacement means termination of employment status, which is a dead wrong statement as a matter of the underlying labor law that all the parties are required to adhere to.
What's the effect?
Go ahead. We do have the August 6th letter that talks about there are no employment positions open. Does that letter function as the something more than the simple hiring of replacements?
No, it doesn't. The reason it doesn't is because anytime you hire permanent replacements, there are at least for if you take a snapshot in time, and you really have to take it as a snapshot because positions open, people quit. Work changes, but at a particular snapshot in time, there will not be an opening potentially for some of the striking employees by virtue of the permanent replacements being in place. But the federal labor law says those people who are on strike remain employees, must remain employees, and have reinstatement rights, both during the strike and after the strike. And it's the distinction between going from there to saying, I don't care, which is this is what was in Baugh, where the employer said, once this strike is over, if those permanent replacements are there, you're gone. This is what they said in Baugh, and that's how Baugh concluded that the employer had terminated the status of the people's employees. There's no termination of status here. In fact, if you look at the facts as a whole here, what you see is that the Conley Company was negotiating about all this. The entire issue of permanent replacements was negotiable. You see, I don't think it's in the August 6th letter, but if you go back to the July 19 letter, and even before that, you see that the Conley is constantly saying, I'm putting permanent replacements on the table. This is a matter for negotiation. Here is my position. And the union, of course, took a very hard-line position, which was its right in labor warfare, to say, all or nothing. If you don't take back every one of us, you don't get to take back any of us. That's a perfectly valid bargaining position, but it's certainly incompatible with their status of the employees as being ready and willing and able to work. Well, which is the foundation of the unemployment compensation.
Counsel, I asked your co-counsel what the rule of law should be, and when I reiterated it, he agreed that that would be. And what I said, that before the striking worker is entitled to unemployment benefit, they have to, when there's permanent replacement workers, ask to be reinstated and be rejected.
Yeah.
Now, you're stating that they can ask to be reinstated and be told that you're put on a waiting list. You're still in the ranks of what we consider our B team, and then they can get unemployment, or they can't.
The positional law we advocate is if they request reinstatement and they're rejected, then they have expressed a willingness to work. The employer has not taken them back to work. They gain the entitlement to unemployment compensation at that point because they've taken themselves off of a strike. The foundational point that we make is, how can you be ready and willing to work, which is the foundation of unemployment compensation, if you are on strike? Strike is a withholding of services, a perfectly valid right under labor law.
But why would they apply for reemployment if they received a letter saying your position is no longer open?
The letters that they receive, if you read them in context of each one of them, say that at this particular point, positions are closed. August 6th is when they finally got that letter. Let's take that. At that particular date, there were no positions that were open to be filled. Had somebody applied for a reinstatement at that point, then the Conley Company would have had to make the decision. Do I jettison my permanent replacements to take these people back? Or if my propositional law is the correct one, do I then take the consequence of financing, through unemployment comp, people being on a strike so that I can have my permanent replacements?
Well,
but Conley never got that option.
Tell me why that would, that if we held that to be the law, why the result of that would not be that there would never be a lockout then?
Well, a lockout, the strike lockout distinction is one that arises right, this is what Bayes was dealing with, where there's been no work stoppage left. The lockout scenario is one in which the employer withholds services from a willing employee. But how can you withhold services from a striker? A striker is, if they are a striker, an unwilling employee. There's no such thing. You don't have to lock out somebody who doesn't want to work for you anyway. So it's only once the person asks you, I want to work, and you say, I'm sorry, I want to stay with my permanent replacement, that the
But you already informed them of that by your August 6th letter, that there's no jobs for you people.
No, the August 6th letter simply said that there were no, that every position had been filled by a permanent replacement.
Well, doesn't that equate to no jobs available?
At that particular time, subject to negotiation.
Well, wait a minute. Did your letter say at this particular time, subject to negotiations, the door is always open, come on back?
That August 6th letter did not. But the July 19 and the others did.
Subsequent to August 6th, was there a letter to these employees saying, come on back?
Actually, it's interesting you mention that because in the director's file, it wasn't an exhibit at the actual unemployment compensation hearing. There were two letters because two employees subsequent to that August 6th letter had said, can I come back to work? And they were told yes. And in fact, there was a letter written to memorialize that fact. They were dissuaded by the union from following through and they didn't come back to work. So the answer is people who inquired afterward were actually told there was work available. Now, it is true that the employer did not on a day-by-day basis say, okay, today no, today no, today no, today no. But you can see that the difficulty with all that, that is the employer is faced with people who are trying to essentially dictate the terms in economic warfare. Fair enough. But that carries with it the fact that they're saying, I will not work for you. And under the unemployment compensation statute, how do you award benefits to someone who is taking the posture, I will not work for you? And I think that's the foundation that we see for applying the Baugh rule to the other side of the factual coin. Baugh applied it to the coin where termination of employment occurred. We're asking you to essentially flesh Baugh out to the scenario where termination of employment has not occurred so that you don't have the errors that the Fifth District has made and the Commission has made relative to the Ninth District and the Tenth.
Thank you, Mr. Bixenstein. Mr. Cole.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Douglas Cole on behalf of the Attorney General, representing the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services. Your Honor, this case turns on two well-settled principles of Ohio's unemployment compensation system. First, the eligibility for unemployment turns on the voluntariness of the unemployment. Where an employee is voluntarily without work, they're not entitled to unemployment. Where they're involuntarily without work, they are entitled to unemployment. And second, this voluntariness inquiry is a week-by-week determination. Unemployment that began voluntarily can become involuntary and vice versa. So then this essentially all comes down to a single question. Were the employees not working because of their own choice or because of a choice that their employer made during the course of their labor dispute? And with regard to that question—
Do you equate the hiring of permanent workers with a lockout?
Your Honor, I actually think this is more of a Baugh case than a Bayes case. In other words, the hiring of the permanent replacement workers ends the labor dispute as the proximate cause of the unemployment.
How do you reconcile that with the federal law that says that the hiring of a permanent replacement does not constitute the end of a strike?
Well, the question isn't whether it constitutes the end of the strike. The question is whether it makes the question for unemployment is this unemployment caused by the labor dispute. So it doesn't matter whether the labor dispute's over or not, it just matters whether or not it's causing the unemployment or whether something else is causing it.
Okay, then I go back to my first question. Does the hiring of permanent placement workers constitute lockout?
Well, that would be, I guess, another way of looking at it. That would make it more of a Bayes type of case that would change it from being a strike to a lockout. There's two ways that the disqualification ends. If the labor dispute becomes something— Well, if the labor dispute becomes a lockout, then they're no longer disqualified from unemployment under the unemployment compensation.
Or see, I don't see how you get to the unemployment category, because the unemployment statute is very clear that labor disputes are not entitled to unemployment compensation, because essentially you are making the employer fund the strike at some point if you take that position, unless there's a lockout. So unless you say this is a lockout, you don't fit under the statute.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I disagree slightly with the statutory interpretation there. What the statute says is no individual can serve the waiting period for any week that their unemployment is due to a labor dispute other than a lockout for so long as the unemployment is due to such labor dispute. So even if the labor dispute is ongoing, if it's no longer the proximate cause of the unemployment, it doesn't matter. It doesn't count for this disqualification provision. It's no longer, as the court said in Baugh, the vital question is not whether the unemployment occurred in the course of a labor dispute, but whether it was caused by the labor dispute. Week by week, we ask, is this employee unemployed this week as a result of, caused by, a labor dispute? And once the permanent—
Your position is that the federal law that says hiring employment— permanent employment workers does not constitute a lockout, or does it not constitute an end of the labor dispute? What does it say?
Well, what the McKay case said is that hiring permanent replacement workers does not in and of itself terminate the employer-employee relationship for purposes of federal labor law. And I would also note, Your Honor—
And you say that's immaterial to our issue then.
It is, Your Honor, and I would note in the layoff context, the same is true. It's well settled under federal law that when you lay off an employee, that does not terminate the employer-employee relationship for purposes of federal labor law. They're still qualify as an employee of that company. They get to vote with their bargaining unit. They get to do all those things while they're laid off. They have recall rights. They have all kinds of other rights. So they're still an employee for purposes of federal labor law, but no one would question that as a laid-off worker, Notwithstanding the fact they still have the status of employee for purposes of federal law, they're entitled to unemployment under Ohio's unemployment compensation scheme. So the notion, and I know that's where the other side wants to go, is to drive those two together and say that Ohio's unemployment statutes, you have to lose your status as employee, but it's just not right. I mean, the layoff example is a perfect example of a situation where you're still an employee for purposes of federal law, but perfectly well entitled to receive unemployment. And why that makes sense is because we need to look to this notion of, is the labor dispute the proximate cause of why you don't have a job this week? And we need look no further than M. Conley's own words. I mean, they send three letters. On July 8th, they say, we're going to hire permanent replacements. On July 19th, they say, we hired permanent replacements. And then, lest there be any doubt, on August 6th, they say, we hired permanent replacements, and there are no jobs open, and you're not getting your job back. So at that point, I mean, it's pretty clear, actually, as of July 19, if we look at the letter on July 19, it's clear that these people do not have a job to go to. To use a maybe inapt analogy, they no longer hold the keys to their own jail cell. They're not out of work by their choice. They're out of work by somebody else's choice, by M. Conley's
choice. Counsel, haven't you overstated the August 6th letter? I don't think they said you don't have your job, you'll not get your job back. They say there are no openings. There are no current openings, which certainly can be interpreted that there's no work now. There may be ambiguity. But what about the issue of the employee coming to the employer and saying, I want to work, being told, no, we have no jobs available, and then being entitled to the unemployment?
You know, Your Honor, first, I don't want to overstate, so I'll just quote from the August 6th letter. I must again advise you that all strikers have been permanently replaced, i.e. there are currently no employment positions open. So that's what they say on August 6th. With respect to this question of should we make workers come back sort of hat in hand and say, I guess week after week, because this voluntariness determination is a week-by-week determination. So I guess the rule that they would ask for is that every week, after you've been told, we've got no job here for you, you're supposed to come back hat in hand and say, hey, could I have my job back this week? Could I have my job back this week? Once the employer has said, you've been permanently replaced, I think it's only appropriate that now it be incumbent upon the employer to send a different message, to send the message of your job is open. And in that regard, I would like to point the court to a factual finding that the hearing officer made, and that factual finding is entitled to deference on review, and that's at pages 24 and 25 of the appendix. Here's a factual finding, quote, there are no positions available for members of Local 92 to return to, except for a few positions that become available through attrition. That's it. The hearing officer found there were no jobs. The testimony from Conley's vice president of operations, and I direct the court to page 83 of the transcript, he's asked, if the members of Local 92 return to work today, are there positions for them to go to? And he says, no. There are no positions for them to go to. Again, these people are not without jobs anymore as a result of their choice. As of the time that they're permanently replaced, they're without a job as a result of M. Conley's choice. And I want to be perfectly clear. We're not saying that there was anything inappropriate as a matter of federal labor law of M. Conley hiring permanent replacement workers. That was certainly something they were entitled to do. But at the same time, no one can doubt that the act of hiring a permanent replacement worker meant that job is no longer available. It's no longer there for them to return to. As the vice president of operations said, we can't take them back. We've got a full boat. And now the question is, maybe some positions would come available in the future, and if M. Conley went to these employees and said, would you like to come back today? And they said no. Okay, that raises at least a substantial question. Like we could say, you know, they're still out on strike at that point because they've turned down work. But when an employer unequivocally says there are no jobs, to say that the employee has to, in a sense, waste their time, make the futile effort of going every Monday and saying, I know you told us there were no jobs. Are there any jobs today? And then the next Monday, I know you told us there's no jobs 3 weeks ago. Are there any jobs today?
Is it the combination of hiring the replacement workers plus the communication that you're saying puts us in this situation? Or would it be the mere hiring of the replacement workers that would entitle all the employees to unemployment compensation?
Your Honor, I think that's a little unclear under Baugh. Certainly, Baugh had both factors, had both the permanent replacement and the notification. There were only two letters in Baugh. There's three letters here, and these letters are even more unequivocal than the letters in Baugh if you go back and compare them. So here, we've got both elements in spades. I guess there is something to the notice idea, and that's this. If the employer's hired permanent replacements and hasn't notified the union of that or the workers of that, and they don't show up on Monday, well, that's a pretty good sign that they're still out on strike. But if they've been told, hey, there's no point in showing up Monday, you've been permanently replaced, and they don't show up on Monday, now it's a little harder to conclude that they're not showing up because they're still on strike. So the notification, I think, might serve, and I can see where the court might have focused on that in Baugh, serves that important interest of making it less ambiguous why the employer is not there on Monday. They're not there now because they've been told you've been permanently replaced. In essence, this all just keeps coming down to, you know, how are we going to determine why the employer isn't or the employee isn't working? And so if we have permanent replacement plus notification, that would be enough now, I think, to once again, in a sense, move the ball back into the employer's court and put it on the employer to say, well, you know, employer, you've now told them they don't have a job. You've hired permanent replacements. If you want them to come back to work, it's now on you to go out and say, hey, I'd like you to come back to work. Hey, I have a position for you.
Is that what Baugh now says? Is that the Baugh rule right now?
Your Honor, I think the Baugh rule is that the hiring of permanent replacement workers plus notification is enough to create eligibility for unemployment. I think that's probably the fairest reading of the Baugh case.
Do you see anything, any new law that we could write in this case?
I'm not sure I do, Your Honor. I think it's controlled by Baugh. The court below, I think, got a little bit of a misstep going off in the Bayes direction. The hearing officer and the trial court had both gone off on the Baugh's direction, sort of, and the appellate court changed to Bayes. I'm not sure there's a lot new to say on this subject because really it turns on a factual inquiry of are you involuntarily unemployed or are you voluntarily unemployed? And what the Baugh case was saying is that in the context of a labor dispute, that means we have to ask, is your unemployment caused by the labor dispute, or does it merely occur in the course of a labor dispute, but it's caused by something else? And a perfect example would be, let's say the workers go out on strike, and the factory burns down. Well, now they're not unemployed because they're out on strike. They're unemployed because the factory burned down. So if we didn't have this proximate cause notion from Baugh's, we might say, well, their unemployment occurred in the course of a labor dispute, so they're not entitled to unemployment or eligible for unemployment.
So there is something that we could write about as proximate cause.
Your Honor, the court covered that pretty well in Baugh, I thought. But as counsel pointed out, there is some confusion below. And I think, picking up on Justice Lanzinger's point, some of that confusion turns on this question of notice. I think the Moriarty and the high state cases, which the other side relies on so extensively, the appellate court cases, are ones where the court was pretty careful to say, here, we don't have notice. So the courts below are reading Baugh as saying permanent replacement plus notice, which may be a fair way to read Baugh. And I would just note the Moriarty court, quote, the employees were never informed that they had been replaced. They did not receive a second letter informing them they had been replaced, as did the employees in Baugh. High state, quote, at no time were the employees advised that their positions had been filled and that they were no longer considered to be employees. So this notice question does seem to be percolating in the district, and they're understanding Baugh as, in a sense, having a notice requirement. It may serve some beneficial purpose. I think really at core, the act of permanent replacement in and of itself probably should be enough because at that point there's just no job for you to go back to.
Counsel, permanent replacement doesn't necessarily mean permanent, does it?
Well, it means permanent until they're discharged. This is permanent
exactly.
As any other at-will position.
Well, at that point, they're employees at will. These new workers are
right.
Permanent, using the word permanent, but they're replacement workers who are not protected by any of the union contract language. They are employees at will, subject to discharge. So if management wanted to, they could have discharged all or part or some of the what is termed replacement workers and brought back union people to fill that. So I would think that a notice provision would be necessarily coupled with the hiring of permanent replacement, and a rule stating that the hiring of permanent replacement will trigger the unemployment, or I should say triggers a termination for the union workers, really is insufficient.
That could well be, Your Honor, and I think that, as I said, I think that is the fairest reading of BAW that says that notice is important, and I think we have notice here, and with respect to this notion of discharge, I would just quote from the July 19 letter, quote, "We never intended to discharge all or most of the permanent replacement workers in order to make room on the payroll for the striking workers." So that's a pretty unequivocal statement that we're not going to let these people go just to bring you back to your job. So really, this all comes, as I said, back down to this factual question of why, as of July 19, when they've been told you've been permanently replaced, we're not we're not going to discharge them, why are these people unemployed? It's no longer as a result of the strike. They're now unemployed because they've been permanently replaced, and they've been told they've been permanently replaced. So
counsel, you would disagree then with the statement made by opposing counsel that it would be necessary for the worker, once replaced by permanent replacements, to come back and ask for their job back and then be rejected, and that constitute notice?
Your Honor, if the court wants to overturn BAW, I guess the court could go that direction. I don't believe that's a good rule. I think this is a week-by-week determination, and once the employer has taken the position, you've got no job, to say to the employee every week you have to go back and ask, were you serious when you said that, I think that's just not a good rule.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Connolly, you've well used your time, but you may have 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. With reference to the August 6th letter, the court needs to read the rest of the letter, and it provides there almost certainly will be some positions opening from time to time. But perhaps more importantly, the hearing officer, he mentions the August 6th letter, but he doesn't really get that far, because the hearing officer found that the entitlement to unemployment compensation commenced with the July 19 letter. And the hearing officer therefore found that the mere hiring of replacement workers in and of itself constitutes entitlement to unemployment compensation. And if that, and that was affirmed all the way up the ladder, that is really what we suggest the court should focus on. That ought not be the law in Ohio, and I don't believe it is. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Connolly. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.